yay, oh yay, oh yay. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 05-3091L. United States of America versus Nathaniel Ross Cullen. For the appellant, William Farrell, Mr. Ratner. For appellant, Nathaniel Wall, Ms. Morgan. For appellant, Carol Fitzpatrick, Ms. Julia. And for appellee USA, Ms. Morgan.
Good morning, Your Honor. If it may please the court, my name is Rob Ratliff, and I'm here on behalf of the appellant, William Farrell. I'd like to begin this morning by talking about our Confrontation Clause argument that we included in the appellant's opening brief. The key issue is not so much whether or not expert witness testimony is allowed under the Crawford decision, but whether or not this really was expert testimony. We cited two cases in our opening brief, Springer and Bonsignor, and I think both of those provide an example of what we think the error was in this case. In the Springer decision, the expert witness that testified at trial testified that, among other things, one of the things he did to determine whether or not the firearm and the ammunition that had traveled in interstate commerce was that he had talked to a technical advisor. And based on the conversations with the technical advisor, he determined that, yes, the ammunition and the firearm had traveled in interstate commerce. The court in that case, the appellate court in that case, ultimately said it's fine because the expert witness also testified that he had conducted independent research. He looked at a Winchester catalog and the normal things that they do. In the Bonsignor decision, it was a little bit different. In that case, the expert witness was testifying regarding drug valuation and how much the drugs cost. The expert witness in that case testified that to come up with that valuation, he called an DEA expert in Washington. That expert provided him a valuation. He brought that information to trial and testified as an expert as to what the value of the drugs were. The court ultimately said that that wasn't okay, that the DEA expert in Washington was the person that really should have been the expert witness. But to the bane of the defense bar, the court ultimately held that that really was a harmless error and there was no problem with the case.
You want to address our decision in Henry?
Well, the decision in Henry, I think, is has a couple of problems. One, it was...
Problems with the decision?
Well, it has a couple of problems with how it applies to this case. Okay. One, it was denied on procedural grounds, but the court did go into a great amount of detail as to, even if it were not for the procedural grounds, there were some issues. But again, I think they found that it was allowable expert testimony. And the issue here is whether or not, I believe, the issue here is whether or not Detective Harris or Detective Thomas was an expert. And what Detective Thomas was testifying about was evidence that the government was presenting and whether or not that was drug evidence. Now, Detective Thomas testified that his information came from his numerous interviews with cooperating informants over the years, with drug addicts over the years.
This is the same kind of, this is the same expert, actually, as in the Henry case.
Yes, that kept me looking back and forth a number of times because it seemed that. But yeah, it's essentially that same effort, that same witness, and what I think the problem here is that the real experts in this case would have been those confidential informants, those drug users, those addicts, because they're the ones that are have the expert knowledge of what the raw data is. The raw data is the drug market and how drugs are packaged, what drugs look like, how they're used. Those confidential informants, those addicts, they have the expert knowledge. Any of those could have testified that this is what it is based on their experience and their knowledge of the drug culture. Detective Thomas, however, is not the expert. He's one step removed. He's essentially summarizing what he's learning from these other experts, and I think that's a problem. I think that's why this isn't so much a Crawford issue as it's not expert testimony that should be allowed under Crawford because it's this one step removed. It's Detective Thomas interpreting what the real experts are saying. And again, those experts are the cooperating witnesses and the drug addicts and people of that nature. Briefly, I want to talk about...
Excuse me one second. Yes. Just briefly, what's an example of a point that the expert testimony made that, for which you're suggesting they should have called a witness?
Well, he testifies in several places throughout the transcripts regarding the photographic evidence that the government had entered into evidence. And it really goes to the issue of whether or not the Rosewood address was a drug house, whether or not the materials found there were materials consistent with use and packaging drugs. And Detective Thomas testified that the information in those photographs was, in fact, drugs, was, in fact, packaging for drugs, was, in fact, materials for using drugs. And that's what...
So you wanted to get a drug addict up there to say that's what it looks like when I buy them?
I think under Crawford that's what it requires. Someone with that an expert witness is someone with that firsthand knowledge.
Well, a drug addict is not exactly an expert. All he knows is the packaging in one place, if he noticed that.
Well, and that's exactly what's important here, is what is, whether or not that packaging that was found at that house was drug packaging. And that's what's important. A local addict would have been the best expert witness because he knows what he'd been getting from that house, if in fact he had.
I don't want to I don't want to defame the memory of the sainted Johnny St. Valentine Brown, but it seems to me that he testified to this effect 200 times without, and we have entertained every variable of objection without upholding any of them.
He did, and that's an interesting example that creates problems, but that shows the inherent problem with allowing this type of testimony once removed. I mean, there's ways to do it. I mean, and that is got to be to have those people with that firsthand knowledge.
What was your other next point you were going to go
to? Well, the other point, I just want to briefly touch on it, Your Honor, is on the money laundering issue. And my office sent...
An expert on physics has to have firsthand knowledge of other planets?
He has to have firsthand knowledge of the raw data.
The raw data being other people's observations.
No.
A scientist reads the literature and so on and then tells you what it summarizes.
A scientist who conducted the experiment would then have firsthand knowledge and be an expert witness.
Right, right. But if you have a scientist instead who teaches the subject and has read all the literature, he has never done an experiment himself.
In my opinion, would not be a qualified expert.
Okay. That's that puts it in perspective.
Only briefly I want to touch on the money laundering case, and we sent to the court yesterday a recent decision from this circuit. I wish they would put these names phonetically in the case reporters, but Ada Fajente was a bank and mortgage fraud case, and I think there's a key quote in that case. The court stated that, you know, having Ada Fajente having originally carried out a fraud of which concealment was an integral part, the defendants can then not be charged with the same concealment a second time if it was as if it was a sort of independent manipulation of the proceeds required for money laundering. In this case, the defendant is charged and was convicted of maintaining the drug house. The things that he did were he paid rent, maintained the building, paid, you know, the money orders to pay for the rent. Those were the same kind of things. Those are the types of things that are just simply spending of proceeds that we would say does not rise to the level of money laundering. And in fact, it's duplicitous. It's a double charge. He's spending money to maintain the drug house, but he's also then getting charged with money laundering for simply spending that money to maintain the drug house. And to the extent that this Ada Fajente holding would apply, I would say that it would apply in this case. It's that same double charge for the same conduct. I reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you,
Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. Catherine Kelly on behalf of the United States. First, in responding to the Confrontation Clause argument, much of the argument the defense counsel just made was not in his briefs. The true issue here is that Henry governs this situation in this court, and the court has already stated, not in dicta, that Crawford did not alter an expert's ability to rely without repeating to the jury otherwise inadmissible evidence in formulating his opinion under 703. Rule 705 of the Federal Rules of Evidence also allows experts to give their opinions without reciting what the people he's relied upon have told him in the first hand. Thomas was an expert in this case. He was accepted by the defense uncontested as an expert in narcotics, and all experts who testify in front of the court are truly gleaning information from other people during the course of gaining their expertise and formulating their opinions on that. All experts learn and gain their knowledge from discussing with other people what they know about whatever topic it is they're discussing on the stand. Juan Signore was an 11th Circuit unpublished decision that's not binding on this court, and essentially all that said is the wrong expert was on the stand because you were parroting exactly what somebody from the DEA in Washington, D.C. told you. Here it's a completely different situation. Detective Thomas never stated in his own testimony what particular crack addicts had told him or referred to past interviews during his own testimony. So we have not only the same expert as in Henry, but the exact same factual scenario in which this court necessarily found that Crawford did not apply to expert testimony. And in turning to the money laundering issue, Ada Fajente is a different case. First of all, it's a substantive money laundering case. There, the defendant's role was merely to obtain money in a bank account in his own name from potentially a fraudulent check in a straw buyer's name. The money was placed in that defendant's account, Mr. Bodie's account, in a named account for Mr. Bodie. There was no concealment in that case, therefore, the court found.
What's the, this is $600 a month. This is a multi, what's the total amount of money involved in this entire operation?
The drug conspiracy or just simply paying the mortgage?
I mean, the opening statement refers to million.
It was over the course of at least the 8 years that was charged, when you take into account that Mr. Farrell and Mr. Fletcher were both receiving anywhere around, say, $24,000 to $28,000 per kilo, there was a huge amount of money involved. I haven't done the math.
Okay, yeah,
certainly.
So that answers the question, though. A huge amount of money involved, and money laundering is $600 a month and a mortgage payment?
Yes, but the point is in regard to.
And that money matches the amount roughly that they were getting in the rents, so they were just paying, basically they were managing the property, collecting the rents, and paying the mortgage.
It's a little unclear how much money they were gaining from the rents, but certainly there's testimony the apartments were let out at different times.
$600 a month doesn't really do a whole lot to conceal the drug proceeds.
But the court has said in Braxton Brown Smith that you don't have to parse out where the licit funds and the illicit funds came from and which pot of money was used to pay. And the same thing
is
in
your theory anything more than that they were spending the proceeds here?
No, it
is become laundering is what I'm wondering.
It becomes laundering because Mr. Farrell in this case wasn't just paying the mortgage in his own name. He was taking out money orders in Carlene Thomas's name and
she
paying
owned the building.
Yes, she owned the building, but he believed in his own test from the phone calls in the case that clearly show that he believed he was gaining a property right in that building by painting the mortgage.
Suppose for the moment that it wasn't his name, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And he's making these payments. I mean, he'd be getting a property right with the equity portion of each payment, right?
If the mortgage was in his name and the building was in his name as well, yes.
So is that still money laundering?
No, because in that case, there's no concealment. Here what we have going on is he is paying the mortgage in somebody else's name, believing that he's obtaining a property right in that property.
Okay, so from whom is he concealing what?
He's concealing from the bank that he's paying for the building. His additional actions
would
also.
Would it be contrary to his interest of the bank? No. Would that be against interest?
Given that his name wasn't on the mortgage, it may not be contrary to his interest insofar as the bank couldn't go after him for the funds, but certainly he doesn't want to put his name out in the public to anybody, be it the bank or be it particularly the government, showing that he has any interest in this property. For instance, Ms. Thomas testified that he would pay the mortgage, but when it came time to pay, for instance, the sanitation bills or fines regarding the building or it came time to file taxes and that sort of thing, he wanted nothing to do with it. Not only would he not make those payments, he wouldn't give her any money for those payments too.
So he didn't want the government to know, but he didn't care if the bank knew.
He did apparently care that the bank knew very much here because he was making payments in Carlene Thomas's name as well. So he's trying to conceal from anybody else around him in this case.
Well, we don't know that he's trying to conceal. What we know is, I mean, that's the inference you want to draw, right? What we know is that he is using the name of the real owner.
That's correct.
Right? Which may be the right thing to do rather than have the bank receive a money order, a payment from somebody not on the papers and get it credited wrong or what have you.
Well, there's certainly no evidence of that in the testimony at trial or any of the evidence at trial.
Let's suppose he wanted to conceal that he was spending money on this, on the payments for the building. Mm-hmm. May want to conceal it for any number of reasons. Why is it laundering?
Because he's taking the illicit funds from his drug dealing, which the court doesn't have to parse, mm-hmm. and he is using that money to pay for the building, to pay the mortgage.
But we really don't know that. I mean, doesn't the government at least have to show that the legal business did not generate enough money to cover it, and so therefore the funds were coming from some illicit source? But here, there's no indication that the rents that they were collecting wouldn't have paid this mortgage, is there?
No, there isn't any evidence to that fact, but the court in Wynn has said there was a case there where a straw buyer was buying Range Rovers for a major drug dealer, and that major drug dealer provided evidence at trial that he had just won $150,000 in the Maryland lottery. And the court still found that there was concealment going on and that there was money laundering going on because he was buying those cars through somebody else, putting the cars in somebody else's name. And the court didn't parse whether or not that $150,000 of legal proceeds was enough to cover the price of the Range Rovers. And also in Braxton Brown Smith, the court has instructed that the government doesn't have to trace the funds and specifically show how illegal funds were used if there's evidence that there's legal funds that could have been used as well.
Does your theory depend on the point that Farrell thought he owned the property?
That does have a role in it, that he believed he thought he was buying the building. He thought that he was doing something with his drug proceeds that was both going to allow him to have a property interest in the building and, in addition to that, keep that property actually in somebody else's name so it couldn't be traced to him. So that is a part of our argument. And I think another main point of our argument is that this is a sufficiency of the evidence decision for the court to make. And you have, in viewing the light most favorable to the government, all the arguments the government is making can be reasonably inferred from the evidence that was placed in front of the court.
Well, it's very close to the idea that spending money is money laundering. So this is.
But still, we have that element of concealment here, where Farrell's—he's using money orders. He's.
What if he just paid in cash?
It's the ultimate concealment.
It is the ultimate concealment. I don't know if the mortgage company would have accepted that.
Paying in cash is money laundering under your theory.
If you're doing it, trying to conceal, which he never did that. But if you were trying to conceal,
he went and bought a car with cash. Is that money laundering?
He did because the money or the. Fact that Wynn bought the car and placed it in somebody else's name was concealment. And we have the same situation here because he was trying to pay the mortgage in somebody else's name. He did pay the mortgage in Ms. Thomas's name time and time again.
This is much more ambiguous because she is the legal owner of the property. It's not even clear that he could have paid it in his name.
But the point here is that he was trying to gain, he believed he was trying to gain a property interest in that property because of the conversations that he had with Ms. Thomas. It's clear when she came to try and sell the building, he was saying to her, what right do you have to do this? I've been paying the mortgage for 4 years, for 5 years. Why? How do you think you can come back now and try and sell this building from underneath me?
And didn't she refuse a couple times when he wanted to actually buy, pay off the rest of the mortgage and give her a little something on the side? She refused that, right?
She refused that because when she, the testimony is.
So he presumably knew from that that he was not the owner.
Yes, but this is at the time, at the end of the conspiracy, post September 2001, when she had taken over the building again, started paying the mortgage again. Those are when those conversations were occurring. So, and if the court has no questions.
The defendant has argued at length that the introduction of his of IRS records showing that he didn't pay taxes was prejudicial.
Yes.
Now, just assume, contrary to your instincts, that the issue we just discussed is a close one. Okay. Such that if there is a, if there's any problem with the introduction of the tax records, it might be fatally prejudicial to this close, to, it might tilt this close issue. What is the inference to be drawn, or what is your reasoning for the inference to be drawn, and what is that inference from the fact that he didn't pay tax, file a tax return for the relevant years?
Well, first of all, in this case, the court did not accept the lack of tax filing as evidence in regard to the money laundering charge. The court specifically rejected that and said that it could only come in as to the other charges. So we don't have
a
situation.
Was there a limiting instruction?
I would have to double check on that. I don't believe that there was one. But the court had specifically rejected it in that regard.
If there is, get back to us, but I, let's assume there was no limiting instruction, okay? Mr. Ratliff will tell us later. All right, so there's no limiting instruction. This comes in, as far as the jury is concerned.
For any reason.
To all accounts, including this one. What's the relevance of the tax return to the money?
Well, the relevance would show that he had a source of illicit proceeds.
But in fact, he had a source of illicit proceeds.
He did, but our point at trial and now is that his licit proceeds were not sufficient to cover the lifestyle that he was living. And granted, it wasn't an extravagant lifestyle like you see with some major drug dealers, but he was paying for trips for groups to go to New York City time and time again. I believe there were at least
twice.
There were, Mr. Valentine Bay, I believe, testified there was at least nine occasions that he went and on these group trips to New York City where Mr. Farrell paid for everything. Mr. Farrell's running this recreation center.
Over how many years was it?
I believe it was sometime between 2000 and 2003. I'm not entirely certain on the dates.
And how much would each such trip cost?
There isn't any specific evidence as to how much each such trip cost, but in each case.
Apparently he rented a van.
He rented a van. He put up the people on the trip in hotels and spent the weekends in New York.
So it might have been $2,000.
I would imagine it would be more than that, but there isn't any specific evidence on the record.
New York prices, maybe $3,000 each trip.
So his licit funds shown in the records that he did place in trial to show he was making anywhere about $8,000 to $10,000 a year, which doesn't cover very much.
Okay, but that may be, but failure to file a tax return doesn't connect so clearly to having illicit income, having high expenses and low legitimate income is a probative point. But why does that require the tax records?
Well, the tax records again show that you have a lot of income, or the lack of tax refunds shows that you have a lot of income that is not being.
No, it doesn't show that at all. It shows that you may be. It shows
you're hiding
you,
it. It's
you may
concealment.
Be hiding something. Right?
Exactly.
You may be hiding something, but then you may be hiding the fact that you live off of you don't have a legitimate income and you live off of an illegitimate income.
Correct.
I think that's what the Hinton court said, right?
Correct.
But he did have a legitimate income. Whether
correct.
He could live off of it is a different matter that goes to the lifestyle question.
That's correct. It does go to, but it's a different matter, but it's a related matter.
Well, is it logically related, not filing the tax return? Suppose he had $100,000 in legitimate income, mm-hmm. $300,000 in illegitimate income, and the guy, he's a criminal, so he decides he's going to evade taxes as well, so he doesn't file a tax return. Nothing about extravagant lifestyle, no evidence of that. He just didn't file his tax return. Does that show he had illegal income? In addition to his legal income?
It doesn't show anything, but again, it is showing that he's concealing.
He's a bad guy.
He's concealing. He's got the
kind of guy who conceals things.
Yeah, but again, that's one of the reasons that the court did not allow it in for the money laundering purposes in
well,
this
the
case.
Well, the court kept it out, I think, on four occasions, something like that, three or four rulings, and then correct. Said, okay, can come in on these as to these other counts.
Correct.
But if there's no limiting instruction, that's not going to help. And if there is a limiting instruction, there's still a decent argument of prejudice here.
But that's not an argument that's been made here, and the court didn't find that in its decision.
I'm sorry, are you saying that Farrell's not arguing prejudice from the introduction of the tax records?
Well, he is, but insofar as they were not brought in to show money laundering, then that prejudice is not in existence. We can't...
No. And so if there's a limiting instruction, it's something to say in rebuttal to his argument that this was prejudicial.
Right.
That's all.
Right. But the court didn't find, in finding the evidence of money laundering sufficient, that that was causing any prejudice to the defendant, and we...
I understand that the district court didn't.
Correct.
Okay.
Thank you.
Judge Ginsburg, I want to give you one brief example on the expert witness and kind of a clear example as to why I think we're that one step removed. If we have a situation where a chemist weighs a quantity of drugs, then writes down that weight, that chemist is the expert. That chemist is the one that conducted the test. She's the one that should be testifying at trial. That chemist weighs the drugs, writes down her results, and then someone later comes in and reads that report into evidence. That person is not an expert, and what that person is testifying to violates Crawford.
And suppose that person reads 30 reports and testifies that the way in which these reports are ordinarily presented is such and such.
That's fine, but the ultimate question of how much drug weight that chemist tested is not permissible under Crawford. That the tests were conducted, that they were conducted in the right way, that's okay.
Was there a limiting instruction on the...
My recollection is there is no limiting instruction on the introduction of the tax records. It came in kind of at a late part in the proceedings, and there was no limiting instruction given.
Are you certain?
I am 99% sure.
I think it would be useful if you and Ms. Fletcher sent a letter to the court within the next, well, let's say by close of business Monday.
Not a problem.
Addressing this question about the record. Ms. Fletcher, thank you. Copy each other, of course.
Thank you. Thank you, Judge.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Michael Morley, and I represent appellant Nathaniel Law. This appeal is about whether Mr. Law, who was convicted of a series of nonviolent, relatively small-scale drug offenses, will die in a federal prison cell. I will begin by addressing the two key problems with Mr. Law's mandatory sentence of life imprisonment without release, and then turn to the entrapment issue. First, Mr. Law should not have received a mandatory life sentence based on the total amount of drugs he sold in the conspiracy. If a defendant distributes small amounts of drugs on several different occasions, he has committed multiple separate offenses. The government cannot add together all the drugs a defendant distributed on those different occasions to impose an enhanced sentence based on that total. A distribution defendant cannot get a mandatory life sentence unless he sells at least 50 grams of crack or 5 kilograms of cocaine powder at one time on a single occasion. And that, I believe, is common ground between me and the government, and several courts have held to that end.
Several courts have held the opposite, though, on the conspiracy.
On the conspiracy point, Your Honor, yes. But as far as distribution, the Sixth Circuit, the Second Circuit, as far as I'm aware, every court has agreed you cannot add together separate distribution offenses and impose a mandatory sentence on that total, because the whole purpose of the mandatory life sentence provision is not to go after street-level hustlers, but major drug kingpins like Manuel Noriega, who incidentally got a shorter sentence than Mr. Law. Under the drug conspiracy statute, the sentence...
See the Panamanian strongman?
Yes, Your Honor, a drug kingpin. Under the drug conspiracy statute, 21 U.S.C. 846, the sentence for a person convicted of conspiring to commit drug-related offenses must be, quote, the same as a sentence he would receive for actually committing those offenses. Thus, a person cannot get a mandatory life sentence under 846 for conspiring to distribute drugs unless he conspires to sell at least 50 grams of crack or 5 kilograms of cocaine on a single occasion. If a person who conspires to sell small amounts of drugs on several different occasions is sentenced to mandatory life imprisonment, then he is not getting the same sentence as the person who actually distributed small amounts of drugs on several occasions. The district court in this case made two types of errors under the statute. First, it made a legal statutory error because it issued a mandatory life sentence based on the jury's finding of the total amount of drugs Mr. Law sold, which made he, as a conspiracy defendant, get a different sentence than someone who would have been convicted of committing those same offenses. The court didn't use the standard set forth in 846. But it also committed constitutional Apprendi error because a jury never made the critical findings required by 846 to have the enhanced sentence imposed. It never found that he conspired or agreed to distribute more than 50 grams of crack or 5 kilograms of cocaine on a single occasion. None of the substantive offenses Mr. Law was indicted for or convicted of involved more than 50 grams of crack or 5 kilograms of cocaine. The plain error standard is met here. There was error. It is plain because the court simply misapplied the plain text of 846. It did not give Mr. Law the same.
You can have plain error when all these other circuits have gone the other way on this question?
Well, Your Honor, this court has held that if a court misinterprets misapplies the plain text of a statute, in United States versus Joaquin, for example, is one of this court's rulings stating that, then that does constitute plain error. It does not. That ruling did not speak to what would happen if other circuits had come to different conclusions, but the Supreme Court has held that a statute can have clear meaning and not be ambiguous despite the fact that other courts have come to a different conclusion. So because our argument here is based on the plain text, the plain meaning of the statute, the fact that other courts have held otherwise under Supreme Court precedent does not preclude this error from being plain. The error here clearly prejudiced Mr. Law because it resulted him in getting a mandatory sentence of life imprisonment without release, and it does affect the fundamental fairness of these proceedings. As this court held in United States versus Coles, leaving in place an error-infected sentence that would have been materially different absent error and could be readily corrected does affect the fundamental fairness of judicial proceedings. The second main problem with Mr. Law's mandatory life sentence is that his prior convictions were not felonies. In United States versus West, this court held that a prior conviction can lead to a mandatory life sentence only, and I quote, if it is characterized as a felony by the controlling law. Mr. Law's prior convictions for cocaine distribution were under DC Code 33541 as it existed in 1989, 1994, and 1996. No matter what mode of statutory interpretation you choose to use, drug distribution under 33541 is not a felony under the DC Code. Starting with the plain text of the statute, the word felony does not appear anywhere in the statute. There is
you have a good argument on the statute, perhaps, but what about the DC cases? What are we to do with those?
As I went into in greater length in my reply brief, Your Honor, putting aside Reynolds for a moment, every single case that the government cited and every other case that I found that I set forth in my brief, all of those cases that discussed a definition of felony were all based on statutes that either have been repealed or that are inapplicable. Henson versus United States, Stevens versus United States, all of these either directly cited to a statute or cited to earlier cases that themselves relied on a statute, 18 U.S.C. 541, which was later codified as 18 U.S.C. 1. All of these cases relied on that statutory definition, but that statutory definition was repealed before Mr. Law committed any of these offenses. This court cannot conclude that there is a common law definition of felony in D.C. based on cases all of which relied directly or indirectly on a statute that has been repealed. In Budd versus United States, this court relied on the definition of felony set forth in 18 U.S.C. 3559. It should not do so in this case, however, because only a few sections earlier in 18 U.S.C. 3551, The United States Code explicitly says that the definition in 3559, and indeed all of the provisions of that chapter, do not apply to a defendant who is convicted under an act of Congress applicable exclusively in the District of Columbia. So the definition in 3559A that the government attempts to rely on versus Budd explicitly says it doesn't apply to the United States Code. As I explained at greater length in my brief, both Congress and the District of Columbia have expressly chosen to characterize in the 8994 code a variety of offenses as felonies, and yet it chose not to do so here. The District of Columbia and Congress had two statutory definitions of felony in the DC code as it existed at the time, but both of them were carefully and expressly limited so as not to apply to drug distribution. And indeed, under one of those definitions, drug distribution would not have fallen within it anyway. If you look to the legislative history, the statutes under which Mr. Law was convicted was a codification of the Uniform Controlled Substances Act, the official commentary promulgated by the Uniform Law Commissioners and circulated along with the text of that act expressly directed legislatures to change the word crime to the word felony if they wanted to incorporate it into their felony classification system. If you look to every other jurisdiction in the nation, 48 states that use a felony-based crime classification system, every other jurisdiction either followed the legislative history and changed the word crime to the word felony, or promulgated a general definition, statutory definition of felony that drug distribution fell within. The District of Columbia did not choose to do that, and there is no common law definition the government can fall back upon precisely because all of these cases that the government cited, that I found in my research, that I included in my brief, rely on federal statutes that have been repealed. The only case that I found that does not fall within that category is Reynolds, where the court cited to a D.C. Superior Court rule naming a particular part of the court, giving that a certain name. When United States versus Law says that a felony must be defined as such under the controlling law, it clearly is not talking about a court rule naming a particular part of the courthouse. Moreover,
that's an argument that the D.C. court was wrong there.
It's that the D.C. Superior Court rule does not fall within this court's definition of controlling law. More to the point, if you again look to the D.C. Code at the time, it had multiple crimes that carried multi-year sentences that it expressly classified as misdemeanors. So the D.C. Code itself defeats the argument that D.C. had a definition that any crime of more than a year punishment was a felony, because D.C. recognized crimes with multi-year penalties as misdemeanors.
Well, that actually can cut either way. I mean, that can show that if when D.C. chooses to make multi-year crimes misdemeanors, it knows that it has to do so expressly. You can argue that. I mean, you can draw a lot of different inferences from that, I suppose.
Yes, Your Honor, except for the D.C. Council and Congress also took the next step of expressly then going through and labeling numerous other crimes as felonies as well and carefully circumscribing its statutory definitions of felony. And again, this court can consider this issue for two reasons. First, it was preserved because Mr. Law's trial attorney refused to concede at the sentencing that there were felonies, and this court has held that a general refusal such, it is held in the sufficiency of the evidence context anyway, that a general refusal to concede such as that or a general challenge such as that is sufficient to preserve any related challenge for appeal. In the case United States versus Hamoud, 51 F3rd 288. But more to the point, again, this also would be plain error because under the plain text of 33541, it was not a felony. Turning to the entrapment issue. A defendant is entitled to an entrapment instruction if there is, quote, any foundation in the record construed in the light most favorable to him that he was induced to commit an offense. Once the defendant satisfies that requirement, the court must issue an entrapment instruction unless the government, again construing the record in the light most favorable to the defendant, proves beyond a reasonable doubt as a matter of law that he was predisposed to commit the crime. This court has held that pleas based on friendship and persuasion can be sufficient to constitute inducement. This court has also held that a defendant must get the instruction even if his entrapment defense is, and I quote, unreasonable, implausible, and weak. This court...
What about the predisposition evidence here, though? It seems like there's a fair amount of that.
Not at the relevant times, Your Honor. This court, in cases that I went into in my brief, has held that simply because a defendant is predisposed to commit a drug offense at particular times doesn't necessarily mean that you can then carry that over that predisposition to other times. And construing the record in the light most favorable to Mr. Law, it is impossible to conclude beyond a reasonable doubt, as a matter of law, that evidence of Mr. Law's drug activities at certain times made him predisposed to commit the offenses at issue here. For example, Mr. Mason admitted that from September to November 2003, he did not have, up until the offense Mr. Law was convicted of on November 25th, he did not have a single drug transaction with Mr. Law. He had to call Mr. Law three and four times a week, repeatedly, week after week, to get him to get Mr. Law to sell him drugs. And the government, despite the fact that this was a multi-year investigation, despite the fact that they had wiretaps, they had cameras, they had secret informants, they had agents tailing the defendants, despite a huge multi-agency investigation, inexplicably, the government just chose not to record any of these conversations. Every drug deal, of course, is carefully recorded. People were wearing wires for all of these drug deals. People were wearing transmitters. But the key conversations in which Mr. Mason repeatedly had to importune Mr. Law, none of this was recorded. If you look to the Atchison transactions, again, in January 2002, when Mr. Law was introduced through yet another government informant who Mr. Law was friends with to Mr. Atchison, there is not evidence as a matter of law beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Law was predisposed at that particular time to sell drugs. And again, the informant in that case was wearing a transmitter, so the FBI could actually hear the conversation, and yet again, they chose not to hit the record button. Of course, all of the subsequent conversations with Atchison during the substantive drug deals, those are in the record. We have transcripts of those. Those were played at trial. But the key conversation in which Mr. Law was induced to participate in this transaction, in which his friend came to him, pulled him aside, talked to him for 10 minutes, lied about Mr. Atchison, said that it was this other informant's brother-in-law, that constitutes sufficient evidence of inducement. It clearly constitutes enough of a foundation in the record to show that Mr. Law was not predisposed as a matter of law, and if a jury were given the opportunity to consider the issue of entrapment, it could have applied it not only to those substantive offenses, but concluded that because these were the key pieces of evidence supporting the existence of a conspiracy, potentially considered the issue of entrapment with the conspiracy as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning again, Your Honors. This is Catherine Kelly for the United States. In turning first to the entrapment argument, the district court used the proper legal standard here and correctly held that Mr. Law had failed to show even some evidence of inducement in this case. There's simply no way, as the court found, to take a lack of evidence and then make a reasonable inference based on that lack of evidence to show that during any conversation with Mr. Law, either with Mr. Mason or with Mr. Atchison, that he was coerced in those situations. The court found that if you want to read between the lines that much and look at a dearth of evidence, you can't just simply infer from that lack of evidence that there was coercion going on. The court parsed the evidence very carefully, and it's clear from Mr. Mason's testimony that even though they were friends, Mr. Mason made no pleas to that friendship. It's clear in Mr. Mason's testimony that he denied any pleas, any threats, any coercion, any rewards being made to Mr. Law to get him to sell drugs. Particularly, Mr. Mason had said that he'd been friends with him for 20 years, that they had a longstanding drug relationship, and Mr. Mason making phone calls to Mr. Law is simply not out of the ordinary, simply just because there weren't any particular drug sales going on. They were friends, they talked to each other all the time, and there's nothing that you can infer from the fact that they spoke to each other four times or three times during October that shows there was any coercion going on, that Mr. Law was not willing to sell drugs for some reason and that Mr. Mason was coercing him. Particularly Agent Bevington, who was in charge of those working with Mr. Mason, said the only reason that the it took until November to get a cocaine transaction in that case was because they were waiting for Mr. Law to have powder cocaine at that time. They weren't recording him because he, at that time, was working with the FBI, and the FBI simply told him, don't make any transactions without us, and call us when he's got, call us when Mr. Law's got some powder cocaine to up for sale. Again, this court has decided in the Evans case that pleas to friendship could be an inducement, but as the district court found in this case, there simply were no pleas. There was a longstanding friendship, but the evidence showed no pleas to that friendship. Turning to the issue of whether or not the court properly aggregated the drug amounts that were attributable to Mr. Law during the conspiracy, the district court here did what district courts do every day. They aggregated the drug amounts over the course of the conspiracy that were attributable to Mr. Law. There's ample Sixth Circuit, Second Circuit, and Third Circuit case law that have all specifically rejected the arguments that Mr. Law is making here, and therefore there's certainly no basis to find plain error where the court aggregated the drug amounts, particularly since conspiracy is a single violation of the law, and it's just a matter of the fact that there are many overt acts to support that conspiracy.
What about the plain language and the idea that you're able to get a longer sentence than you would if there were a series of distribution crimes?
Well, the Martinez case in the Second Circuit had said the congressional intent in enacting 846 for conspiracies was that conspiracies create a greater threat to society than do individual drug sellers. So that if you're going to have, they kind of turned it on its ear and said the purpose of 846 is to ensure that a defendant in conspiracy, when he comes to sentencing, isn't in a better place than somebody that would be charged with possession of the same amount of narcotics on just one occasion.
Put someone who's charged with conspiracy in a much worse place, right?
It places him in the same position that somebody involved in a conspiracy would be in if they had the same amount of drugs on one occasion and was not acting within a conspiracy.
That's the point, right?
Well, the point is that
The point is that an agreement to do a series of small, smaller, drug deals shouldn't be aggregated as if it were an agreement to do one that crosses the threshold, right?
If the person is acting alone and if he's not acting in agreement as part of a conspiracy in concert with others. But that's not the case here. This is not a situation where Mr. Law was acting on his own, going out individually and making drug sales. There's ample evidence throughout the record that he was closely linked with Mr. Farrell and Mr. Fletcher time and time again, and that all of his drug sales were part of his conspiracy actions. And there's no way, given the state of the law, with all those other circuits specifically rejecting the argument that Mr. Law has made here, that this court should find that it's plain error. The district court simply aggregated the drug amounts as it always does, and there's not only no error, there's not only no plain error, there's no error at all for in the district court's actions here.
When you say as it always does, what are you referring to?
Simply, any time the district court has a drug conspiracy case, right, you aggregate the amount of drugs over the course of that conspiracy that were attributable to the particular defendant. And the jury found here.
You're not suggesting we have any precedent on this exact point.
No, I'm not. I'm asking the court to look to the Sixth Circuit, the Second Circuit, and the Third Circuit for that precedent, particularly since this is a plain error test. Turning to Mr. Law's felony argument, first of all, Mr. Law has waived that claim. At no time prior to his sentencing, as he's required to do under 21 U.S.C. 851B, did he challenge his prior convictions on the basis that they were not felonies. And since that statute section requires that the defendant must file a written notice when he's denying any allegation in the government's notice of prior felonies, then he's waived the claim that he's making now that the court cannot consider these prior convictions in the District of Columbia to be felonies. That's supported by the Sixth Circuit in French and the Ninth Circuit in Van Doren. At best, Mr. Law here would get plain error review, but it's also important to note that Mr. Law did not refuse to concede his prior felonies in this case at sentencing on the basis that they weren't felonies. He was saying that he was concerned that if the Supreme Court revisits the Almendarez-Torres case and later finds that a jury has to decide whether or not those prior felonies exist, then he didn't want to have been in a position of admitting them at this point. He never at any point tried to say that they weren't felonies. In fact, Mr. Law's attorney said informally at the sentencing that if it weren't for that issue, that he would concede. In addition, there's no reason to consider, there's plain error to consider these prior convictions felonies. The authority from the DCCA, the Henson case, the Reynolds case.
Without the DC cases, what result?
Without the DC cases, we still have Rule 1 in the Superior Court, which says that if you were going to have a prosecution of a case with a sentence greater than 1 year, that is going to be handled by the felony branch of the court. So again, it's another instance where controlling law in the DC, in the District of Columbia, is showing that.
Why shouldn't we look only at the code and the code provisions of the crimes at issue?
Because Section 802.13 says that the prior has to be characterized as a felony by controlling law. It does not say that you have to look only to statutes to determine what that controlling law is. So it's completely proper for the court to look to common law sources, to look to the District Court of Appeals decisions, and again to look at the Superior Court's own rules in deciding what is a felony. And again, given the authority from the DCCA and the rules, these are in fact felonies. And if the court has no further questions.
Ms. Kelly, for your information, relating back now to Mr. Farrell's argument for just a moment.
Yes.
At 112 of your brief, you say, this was pointed out by my young colleague whose acuity is unimpeded by age and decrepitude, that at 112 of your brief, you write, Farrell also claims that the court's failure to give a limited instruction to the jury as to the use of the tax evidence made it likely that the jury misused the evidence. Farrell never sought a limiting instruction.
That's correct.
And that would not be permitted, et cetera. So apparently there was no limiting instruction.
There was no limiting
your
instruction.
Your argument is on whether that was waived.
And I'd point the court also to page 107 of the brief where it said there was no limiting instruction given, but also that Mr. Farrell had never sought a limiting instruction.
Right. So we have a different question on our hands. We now know the answer. We don't need a letter. There was
okay.
No limiting instruction.
Thank you.
And
but
we have your arguments on whether that was that argument's forfeit.
Thank you. And we would just say that based on the fact that he didn't seek an instruction, that he shouldn't be allowed to benefit from any error that may have purportedly occurred in this case.
Well, unless it was plain, right?
Correct, but we don't believe it was plain error.
No, that's been fully briefed.
It's not
a frivolous question after the judge first denied three or four times allowing it in and then lets it in for a limited purpose but forgets to tell the jury.
Okay. I believe, too, it was only twice the government mentioned it early on and it was denied and then brought it up later on and fully argued it towards the end after the government had rested its case and Mr. Law was, or Mr. Farrell was putting on rebuttal evidence.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honor, first on the aggregation point, the government said that the district court just did what district courts do every day and aggregated drug amounts what it always does. What the government doesn't tell you is that that's what the district courts do under the guidelines. The sentencing guidelines contain dramatically different language from 846. The sentencing guidelines expressly direct district courts to consider all the relevant evidence, all the relevant conduct. Section 846, the drug conspiracy statute under which Mr. Law was convicted, contains different language. It says give someone convicted of conspiring to commit drug offenses the same sentence as they actually would get for committing those offenses. In this case, Mr. Law was convicted of a series of small-scale drug offenses. The district court gave him 17 years on those counts. He was also convicted of conspiring to commit those offenses, and the district court gave him life for that. Life is not the same as 17 years. On the face of it, his sentence violates the statute and violates Apprendi because the necessary factual findings were not made. Regarding the felony issue, this argument is not waived because we are not raising a challenge to the conviction. No matter how this court rules, his prior convictions are going to be just fine. We're not challenging their existence. We're not challenging their legality. This is simply a legal question. As a matter of law, are these convictions for felony offenses or not? And all of the authority that the government cites up here today is based on repealed statutes. These D.C. cases, the D.C. Circuit cases, are based on statutes that Congress repealed or that expressly say cannot be applied to people convicted under District of Columbia law. And finally, regarding the entrapment issue, the government opened its presentation by saying the court applied the correct legal standard. It did not. The district court expressly said that Mr. Law was not entitled to an entrapment instruction because he failed to show that government cooperators, and I quote, induced him to engage in these narcotics transactions that he may not have otherwise been inclined to engage in. It went on to say that Mr. Law did not introduce, and I quote, evidence of some kind of persuasive overture to overcome a lack of predisposition. Thus, the district court impermissibly conflated the inducement prong, which is the defendant's burden, with the lack of predisposition prong, which it's the government's burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt as a matter of law with the evidence construed in the light most favorable to the defendant. The district court held that because Mr. Law did not introduce enough evidence of both inducement and predisposition, he was not entitled to the entrapment instruction. Thus, right out of the gate, the district court was applying an incorrect legal standard and impermissibly putting the burden of showing lack of predisposition on Mr. Law. And under the cases that I cited in both my opening and reply brief, Kennard, Trent, Johnson, this court found enough evidence of inducement and lack of predisposition in even more extreme cases than this, with even more marginal circumstances regarding inducement, and yet held either that an entrapment instruction was required, or that it was properly given, or that a conviction could be affirmed only because an entrapment instruction was issued. If this court looks to the facts of Kennard, Johnson, and Trent, it will find that under facts closely resembling this case, an entrapment instruction was legally required. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Joseph Virgilio, and I'm here on behalf of Appellant Carol Fletcher. Mr. Fletcher raised several issues in his brief, but the issue I want to discuss is the sentencing issue. In this case, the government produced only a docket sheet as proof that Mr. Fletcher had a prior conviction that qualified under Section 841, the recidivist statute. Our position is that for the government to have met its burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, the government was required to produce not only the actual judgment and commitment order, but also the records of the parole commission indicating exactly how the defendant was discharged. Because under the Federal Youth Corrections Act, if he was unconditionally discharged, then his conviction was automatically set aside, and it does not qualify as a prior conviction under Section 841. In our brief, we cited the case of United States versus Price, which states that the docket sheet was unreliable. The docket sheet, Price said that the docket listing would not suffice to meet the government's burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant had a prior conviction because it's not a sufficiently reliable source. It didn't tell the whole story. Docket sheet didn't tell the whole story because even if the judgment and commitment order would also have been insufficient evidence that the conviction qualified under Section 841. In order for the government to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the conviction qualified, the government would have to have produced the parole commission's records showing exactly what type of discharge Mr. Fletcher received.
On this precise issue, if you are correct on this, the remedy would be a remand for the government to put in, if they have, which they say they do, more evidence, right?
Well, yes, but we maintain that even even as it stated, as the government stated in its brief, it had the certified copy of the judgment and commitment order, that still wouldn't suffice where we have the interplay between Section 841 and the Youth Act.
Right. I'm just talking on this precise burden of proof issue. If that were the only issue you were to prevail on, the remedy would be a remand for the government to put in the, is that right?
Yes.
Okay. On the other issue, you on the Youth Corrections Act, you agree, I gather, that an expunged conviction can be used generally in sentencing, but not specifically for a recidivist statute enhancement?
Yes, it can be used for other purposes. For instance, it could be used for investigative purposes, for...
What about sentencing purposes?
For sentencing purposes under the, under, for example, under the federal, the sentencing guidelines, it could be used as a, to be considered.
And what sense does it make to allow an expunged conviction to be used for general sentencing purposes, which could tip the judge to impose a much longer sentence than he or she otherwise would, but not to allow it to be used when it's more narrowly targeted into a recidivist statute like this?
Well, when it's targeted for a recidivist statute, the standard is different. The standard is beyond proof beyond a reasonable doubt, whereas under the just using it for general sentencing purposes, the standard is only a preponderance of the evidence, so that there's a lesser standard for its application.
Well, let's say it's proved beyond a reasonable doubt that there's a prior conviction that was expunged, okay? And you're saying, I think, that the judge, the sentencing judge in a sentencing scheme that's not as structured, could use that expunged conviction to enhance the sentence as one of many factors the judge is considering. And I think you're saying that that's okay, but it's not okay when the sentencing scheme's more structured, for example, in a recidivist statute situation like this one. Is that your argument?
That is.
I'm not sure the logic of the line drawing there. It seems like the expunged conviction should either be prohibited from any use by the sentencing judge or allowed for both purposes, both the general sentencing scheme and the recidivist scheme.
Well, the expunged conviction for purposes of even under the Youth Corrections Act, it can be used for investigative purposes, for a record is kept by the Department of Justice, and it can be used for other purposes.
And several other circuits have held, right, that expunged convictions, they were state convictions, can be used under this statute, right?
That's correct. But those are state convictions.
Mm-hmm.
The reason that the court...
Why does that matter for purposes of the legal issue we're considering here?
Well, the situation is different. The situation where there's the use of state expungement statutes is that the courts have decided that under federal law, the state statutes can be used as qualifying convictions because there's such a mishmash of state statutes, of state expungement statutes.
That's true of federal statutes, too, particularly when we go back, as we have to here, to 1977.
Well, it isn't with respect to the Federal Youth Corrections Act. The Federal Youth Corrections Act has a specific set-aside provision within the statute.
That doesn't, you're right about that, of course, but that doesn't really answer the question of whether it can be counted in a statute, like in a subsequent recidivist statute at sentencing.
Not in a recidivist statute. It's pretty clear that I believe it's a Fourth Circuit case, the case of Ferguson, where the set-aside conviction where the court said that the set-aside conviction cannot serve as a prior felony offense upon which to predicate certain firearms crimes which require a prior conviction, because a conviction which is set aside under the Youth Corrections Act is vacated and has no operative effect.
Okay.
I'd like to reserve my last 2 minutes if there are no further questions.
Your Honors, Catherine Kelly again on behalf of the United States. Here, Mr. Fletcher was properly sentenced to life without release, and the docket sheet provided sufficient proof of his 1977 conviction. There was a certified copy of the district court's own docket sheet in this case provided to the court, and the court is free to take judicial notice of its own records. And that, because of that, there was proof beyond reasonable doubt of his 1977 conviction. In addition, that docket sheet, the information on that also provides sufficient proof that the defendant's conviction was never set aside. And the government, again,
it's automatically set aside.
It's not automatic. There's a series of steps that a defendant has to take to get a set aside. And the very first one of those steps is that the defendant has to be
on release. The statute says after 6 years, automatic.
Yes, but that presupposes that the person has been released and put into the control of the parole commission.
So because Judge Parker gave a better deal here, they actually end up worse off later on under the statute. Is that the theory?
Yes, we would say so, because of the section 1521,
so
where you get the unconditional
discharge. He would have been better off just riding it out and saying, don't give me that, Judge Parker.
He probably would have been, yes, because the whole purpose of that Youth Corrections Act is for a youth to show that he can change his life under the watch of the parole commission and make sure that he's on the straight and narrow. At this point, the defendant bowed out early and said, I want to leave. I don't want to continue on. Can you please reduce my sentence? And the court said, yes, you can. And at the time, from what that docket sheet shows, he had been for no more than 3.5-4 months been placed in the custody of the Attorney General, i.e. incarceration, and then the court had recommended he been sent to Petersburg, Virginia. There's no indication that he had been released, and until you end up being released and put in the probation or the parole commission's system, then you're not
in
that position to get this
set aside. Did
the government
make this clear back at the time what the terms of the release were?
To at the time of the reduced sentence,
mm-hmm.
or? There's no indication in the documents that there was any discussion of what effect this could have on the youth offender portion and the set aside and so forth. All that was presented was a very short motion by his attorney saying that he would benefit from drug treatment outside and that he would, you know, therefore sought a reduced sentence so he could get drug treatment. The court said in a two-line order that he was going to sentence him to time served, therefore. So, again, we're not in that position where we have a youthful offender who has come out of the Attorney General's custody and then been placed under the parole commission's supervision in order to get the opportunity to be later discharged. So we don't end up in a situation where you're ultimately going to get an unconditional discharge under Section 5021. He wasn't under the commission's supervision, and he had not been placed on probation by the judge. It's very clear from the docket sheet itself that he had been incarcerated by the judge. And therefore, we have proven that beyond reasonable doubt as required. If the court has no further questions.
I do. If it is automatically set aside, what's your theory then?
If it is automatically set aside, it's a slightly more difficult argument to say that a set-aside conviction under the FYCA can be used for recidivist statutes, because the Supreme Court in Tooten had implied that in its decision, although it hasn't specifically ruled that, so it's not out. It's just a more difficult argument. However, the DCCA in Barnes, when they were looking at the Tooten decision, they still came up with a very good rationale on why set-aside convictions under the Youth Act, the Federal Youth Act, should be considered under recidivist statutes, and that is that once a youthful offender has his opportunity to have his one bite at the apple as a youngster and turn them away from a life of crime, to then later on, once he has decided to turn back to criminality, to say that we should ignore his prior crimes.
Well, that's a good policy argument. Why shouldn't Congress make that determination, and we as a court leave it up to Congress when they want to include an expunged or set aside conviction in a recidivist statute? For example, the sentencing guidelines are very clear about distinguishing when they can be used and when they can't. But why isn't the default principle that they can't be used unless Congress so provides?
Well, it would be good if Congress did make a specific statement as that, but as the law stands now,
Why isn't the default principle consistent with Tootin that it can't be used?
Because Tootin hadn't specifically said that it can't be used. Barnes, interpreting Tootin, made that additional step and said that it's extrapolating that from what Tootin had specifically held to say that you can't use the Federal Youth Corrections Act convictions that have been set aside for.
Do you think a pardoned conviction can be used?
I am not sure. I guess it would depend if you're talking about a recidivist. There's no reason that I know of that it could not be, but I'm not certain on the law. I don't want to.
So much for the pardon.
So much. I'm not sure. I don't know, and I wouldn't want to say.
Okay.
If the court has no further questions, we would rest on our briefs, and we would respectfully request that the judgments of the district court be affirmed. Thank you.
The government keeps going back to the fact that the docketing sheet was sufficient, and the docketing sheet wasn't sufficient. Mr. Fletcher had been sentenced under the Youth Corrections Act, under 5010B. So he was, at the time that Judge Parker sentenced him to time served, he was still under the disability, he was still in the custody of the Attorney General and under a 5010B sentence in Petersburg. So he still would have had to have been discharged, and the parole commission still would have had to have discharged him. And there would have been some record as to what that discharge was, whether it was conditional or unconditional. And our point is that if it was conditional, or if it were conditional, then the government would have to have had those records and brought those records to, had certified copies of those records to show that he was conditionally discharged. As such, the government didn't meet its burden by just producing the docketing sheet per se.
I think you're conflating two issues here, right? One is whether there was a proof of a prior conviction, and you're saying the docket sheet's not good enough. The other gets into the whole question of whether it was set aside under the Youth Correction Act. And I'm not sure your first argument can control the second one.
Well, that is correct. And our position would be that we didn't know, in fact, under the proof that the government presented.
Your position is that under the statute it's automatically set aside.
Yes.
And the fact that the defendant got a better deal from Judge Parker shouldn't cause him enhanced penalties later on than if he had been unconditionally released and gone the full length.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Bridgman.
Thank you.
Thank you all. The case is submitted.
Stand, please.